Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of this podcast. Thank you so much for letting me inside your head wherever you are. This is an entirely listener-supported podcast, and I want to let you all know about the best goddamn newsletter on the internet right now. Only Tierman.substack.com, my Friday newsletter that teaches you a new word every single week. I love learning new words, and maybe you do too. So every week, I pick a new word that I just learned. I usually find them in books that I read. Remember those? And I write down that word, and then I include it in the newsletter. That's the subject of the newsletter, and then I write a little something about that word. So if you like growing your vocabulary, and I know you do, I know you love using those big words, you can just click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. It's so easy. It's so simple. Or go to tierman.substack.com. It's a free newsletter. If you want to become a paid subscriber, it'd be pretty cool. I mean, it'd be really cool. But if you can't, tierman.substack.com, free Friday newsletter. Check it out, all you weirdos. This episode of the podcast is with Scott Norton. Scott is a venture capitalist and is one of Mudwater's board members. I worked at Mudwater for 2 years as senior copywriter, learned a ton from that experience and from Scott specifically. Scott is a business strategist and a real creative thinker. So I think that no matter where you are in your career, whether or not you're a business owner or you just want to understand how brands can move laterally and they can make their way into culture in more, what's the word? I need a big word for what I'm looking for right now. I'm at a guy who has a fucking newsletter of words, is at a loss for words. He's just a really smart guy. Before Mudwater, Scott co-founded Sir Kensington's. The brand is best known for making condiments with character, and at Sir Kensington's, he raised over $20 million from investors, guiding the company to a successful acquisition by Unilever in 2017. Scott has been named one of Fast Company's most creative people in business and listed on Forbes 30 Under 30. I hope that you enjoy this podcast. I certainly did. I learned a lot. Scott has some zingers in here that can really help you frame up problem solving in a really interesting way. Keeping one foot in nostalgia and the other in novelty. That was one thing that it's a little gift Scott gave to all of us in this podcast, and you will learn about it all too soon enough. So please give it up for the amazing Scott Norton.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
Not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part about Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
I think there, you know, there are ways that quote unquote marketers, right, or whether they're political strategists or, you know, anyone that's sort of studies or tries to influence groups of people might think of populations in terms of demographics, right? And so, you know, if you, whatever, get an MBA or you study marketing in school, maybe you think a lot about demographics. Like a quote unquote customer is someone that lives in a geographic region that is between a certain, in a certain age group, that is, you know, gendered in a certain way, that has a certain level of income, that has a certain level of educational attainment. This is the definition of demographics. And then there's the concept of psychographics. And that's when we, when I say, yes, we should be communicating to a quote unquote core customer, I'm much more interested in the psychographics, which matters less about exactly what someone's demographic qualities, you know, income, educational attainment, geography, etc. But demographics, or but psychographics, which is how someone thinks, it's how someone understands themselves. It's how they assemble their own identity using the stories that they tell about themselves. And that's where I think it becomes interesting if you are an organization or you're an individual and you're trying to get something out in the world, you're trying to open up people's eyes to it, and your goal is either adoption or influence, right? Is to appeal to this, what I like to call the me I want to be, the sense of assembling the identity. And so where the distinction is interesting is that, you know, as you communicate to a quote unquote core customer, what are you really saying? You'll develop a message that speaks to a voice that's inside of people's heads. And for some people, right, and we'll take the mud, just because we're on the Mud podcast, right? Let's take the Mud character. It's irreverent. It's for someone that knows that there's got to be a better way. It's someone that is more biased probably towards natural ways of living, natural solutions, kind of the belief that Mother Nature got it right and that we're living in this broken world. And so it's, first of all, it's our responsibility to like see the broken world, and then it's our responsibility to reject the broken world and seek alternate pathways. In some people's heads, that voice that holds those beliefs is going to be really, really loud, right? Like the founding team of the company, Shane, the founder, if we walk like in this neighborhood around Venice Beach, you're going to find people where that voice is the dominant voice. It's going to be blaring in their heads. It's their way of understanding how the world works. But that voice also exists in much lower kind of decibel levels in people's heads all across the country and all across the world. It could be a 17-year-old, right, who has just started recognizing that the path that they've been sort of fed by traditional education and, you know, the school system and the professional conveyor belt maybe isn't the right move for them, right? And they start to reject that. Or maybe it's someone that has had a long career, right, in working for a government organization and starts to now pay attention to how their body feels, and they start to dip into yoga, and those voices are starting to become louder and louder, but they're still soft. I think as a marketer, you have to say, okay, we have a message, right? And we're speaking to a quote unquote customer, but it's a voice in people's heads. And some customers, that's going to be blaringly loud. And certainly, we should focus, right, practically on making sure they're hearing us, but we shouldn't ignore certain demographics. Instead, we should still speak to that voice and pull that voice out of their heads, make that voice louder, give that voice, you know, something to listen to, basically.
Right.
And that, I think, is the way that I think about sort of the difference between demographics and psychographics, and being essentially a servant to your own message and a servant to that psychographic versus thinking about of hitting the same demographics over and over again.
So, In that answer, like you said, that some people maybe don't even know that that voice exists in their heads.
Yeah.
And you need to, you know, maybe tell the soldier or the farmer or like this, well, maybe actually you do like breath work, or maybe you do want to take pause in your morning to be a little bit more mindful, but you might not even recognize that voice in your head. So when in your career and when generally do you think it's important for marketers to rely on customer data versus hunches? Because if you took one of those groups, like I took the farmer and I'm like, hey, are you interested in mindfulness? They might be like, hell no, I'm not. But you have a hunch that there's a voice in their head that they might actually be.
Mm-hmm.
So when do you think it's important to rely on your own hunches versus doing focus groups or you know, reading the statistics of what people tell you they like?
Yeah, I don't have a rule of thumb here or a hard and fast way to define what tool is right for what job. The way that I think about it is that there's two sort of polar opposites. On one side, if you do everything for yourself and you take kind of full authorship and it's really only your hunch, then you're an artist. On the polar opposite, if you only do things for money and you only rely on, call it, the data or the targeting, then you're a hack. And I believe that the happy medium, the center point, is to be a craftsman. And when I think about building companies, communicating as a brand, I think about finding that place of being a craftsman where you're utilizing the right technical tools and targeting, and you're thinking about how do we be practical in terms of the data and the evidence to bring us insights. But you're also never losing sight of the fact that we have a message to carry forward. We think a truth that the more people see it, the better their lives are going to be and the more interesting this world is going to get. So you've got to rely on that as well. And you can never lose sight of that truth that you're telling. You can never lose sight of that belief and go too far in the other direction and essentially, you know, just optimize your way into relevance.
Right, right. When it comes to when it comes to speaking, I've heard a lot of, you know, people in the past, you know, whether it's like Steve Jobs or Simon Sinek, like he talks about the why and the importance of the why. And I listened to that talk that you did. I think it was at a Conscious Capitalism talk, and you talked about how when you initially were telling people the story of Sir Kensington's, you were talking about the how.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this distinct shift when you started storytelling around the why. And you even like created this fictional story of this guy, Sir Kensington, and all of a sudden things started to resonate a bit more. Can you speak about the why more? And you know, to someone who might be just starting out on a business and they're not really sure how to communicate their message, why is that important?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the credit for this and certainly popularizing this really does go to Simon Sinek, who's got this very well-viewed TED Talk, Start With Why. But the concept is basically that our default mode, if someone asks, like, what do you do, right? Or what does your company do? Is to answer with the what, right? So, for instance, Apple, right, would say, like, we make computers or we make phones. Whereas the much more enticing way to position what you do and a tool to give yourself much more reach and much more permission is to start with why and to describe why it is you do what you do. So, for instance, like in the case of Apple, it would be to empower creatives and independent thinkers. And how? Well, we build technical tools for them, and what those end up being, you know, laptops and iPads and iPhones and also, you know, to connect people, things like that. So that's flipping it on its head and starting with the why. What that does is I think it inspires people around a sense of shared purpose to understand, you know, beyond just the physicality of what you do, what your onlyness is, right? What your distinct sort of theory is, what your distinct strategy is in delivering your product that people rally around. And frankly, again, going back to this sense of identity, they see themselves in that purpose, right? Because anyone can make a product, but we want to participate in, enroll in, and, you know, have a relationship, it could be an economic relationship, with people that share our values and share our point of view.
When you exited from Sir Kensington, then you became an investor. What drew you to invest in Mudwater?
So,
I mean, you see a lot of pitches, right?
Yeah.
Like this, so I'm guessing you get these stories coming across your desk a lot. What do you think is the unique, what was unique about Mudwater that piqued your interest?
Yeah. Well, very similar to company building, investing is a wonderful activity of an evolving thesis, right? Because like so many things, you'll have a point of view, you'll have a strategy, you'll have a thesis, and then, like, as Mike Tyson famously says, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right? And when you get punched in the mouth, your thesis has to evolve. So it was something that definitely evolved over time, though I'd love to take a step back here, because your question is a great one, but it also raises this question of, like, well, what's the purpose of this? Why do I do what I do? Like, why are these companies even important, right?
Yeah.
And what I've always been enamored by companies' abilities, and call them brands, right? Organizations' abilities to influence and change culture and kind of nudge it in the direction that is within the vision of certainly the founders, but also the team, right? And I don't want to assign too much kind of moral responsibility on, is a company nudging it in a good direction? Is it nudging it in a bad direction? That's kind of a different question. But what we always tried to do with Sir Kensington's was invent a world that we wanted to see more of, right? What if we could create something, a better version of the lowliest condiment, ketchup, with real ingredients and care to the entire constructed proposition of it, that someone could all of a sudden pay attention to food in ways that they didn't pay attention to food before. And they started thinking about their own taste experience. They started thinking about the purity of the ingredients and the clarity of the supply chain. And they started making meals a special moment because of this little magic that they could put on top of it in the form of condiments, right? We could imbue a special experience into something that was previously unremarkable. And I think there's a cool nugget there. And when I started investing and talking to, entrepreneurs all across the spectrum and consumer, which is basically businesses that sell to consumers, to be, I think, successful, or certainly to build the type of companies that I want to be involved in, you've got to have a point of view of where you want to lead culture, right? And push culture and create, like we were talking earlier in this, showing people that there's a better way and opening their eyes to something interesting. And I'm also a big art fan. So I love art. I love, fine art. I love low art. I love all kinds of art because of how I think it allows us to reflect on our own, civilization and society. And I'm going to answer your question, but I want to read, a description of a German artist, Joseph Beuys, who had this phrase called social sculpture. And he's a mid-century German artist. And the definition is, social sculpture is a phrase used to describe an expanded concept of art that was invented by the artist and co-founder of the German Green Party, Joseph Beuys. Beuys created the term social sculpture to embody his understanding of art's potential to transform society. As a work of art, social sculpture includes human activity that strives to structure and shape society or the environment. The central idea of a social sculptor is an artist who creates structures in society using language, thoughts, actions, and objects. And going back to why I originally became interested in business was because, I love art, I love film, and so many of those things in the creative realm, they stay very small.
Right.
And they take money to build, right? It takes money to build, whether it's an installation art, a piece of art, even a canvas or a film, right? Or to record an album. But oftentimes those things aren't, profitable. They're not self-sustaining. And what business is, when done right, is essentially an art project that generates enough money to get bigger and bigger and grow and self-sustain and, create livelihoods in the process and to be this kind of like self-sustaining social sculpture. So the most interesting businesses for me, I would define them as social sculpture, right? There's something that, of course, they're a business, right? They make money, they spend money, they've got employment contracts. Oftentimes, they've got investors. Certainly, they've always got owners. But they are a flywheel that is a self-sustaining engine for a platform to shape culture. Those are the most interesting businesses for me. And when I first came across Mudd, I was absolutely impressed and and floored by the amount of traction that the product had gotten. I was floored by, I think, the operational excellence that I saw in the company, you know, which I think previously, as I just, when I saw Mud from the outside, I was like, okay, this is like run by some like hippie surfers in Venice Beach. Like, who knows where this is going? When I got under the hood, I was quite impressed by that. But aside from those gating kind of business factors, what I saw was absolutely this social sculpture where the leadership team and, you know, to celebrate Shane for a minute, the founder was someone that was so dedicated to the first principles thinking around how should we live and what should we question. And it was coming to me at a point in my life where I'm a pretty healthy guy, but I love coffee, right? Coffee, you know, I love any kind of mind altering states, any stimulation in general. So like a cup of coffee, right? You feel that elevation, you feel that elation, great. But of course, what I found myself doing was drink a second cup of coffee expecting the same results. Drink a third cup of coffee. It tastes amazing. It's creamy. It's warm in your hand, right? It's comforting. It's something to do. Oral fixation, right? Something to hold in your hand. And then by like 11:30 in the morning, I'd be absolutely, right?
Jittering.
Overly
jittery
stimulated.
Shell of jittery, yourself.
Jittery and, you know, couldn't focus. And For Shane and for Mudwater to have this message of, hey, if you drank a cup of coffee today, you're on drugs. That really clicked for me as, okay, that is a provocative statement that is the beginning of a social sculpture. And what are the things in society that are these, completely commonplace, totally socially acceptable, maladaptive behaviors, right? Of which certainly like social media use and like drug use in many forms, but like drug use in the form of coffee abuse, right? Coffee overconsumption is absolutely one of them. That really got my attention because it spoke to me personally, but also the way that the conversation was all of a sudden deflected so elegantly into something that looked like coffee, right? That had the same mouthfeel as coffee, that was customizable and personal like coffee, that had the same culture and process of preparation as coffee, but in and of itself wasn't coffee. To me, that is social sculpture, right? That is kind of a little magic trick. And so I fell for the magic trick of Mud as a consumer. And after really getting to understand the team and understand the company and see the potential of where we had to go, it was, frankly, as an investor, it was the first company that I ever believed in so much that I not only put my own money into it, but I also brought other investors. And I basically invited myself onto the board after convincing...
While everyone was getting into crypto in 2018, you were getting into Mud.
Yeah, I wish it was 2018. I was a little later than that. But yeah, crypto, I mean, has never been for me. You know, crypto is absolutely social sculpture, probably for, you know, more intelligent art collectors than I. But, you know, Mud was a company that I said, this is a mission that I want to be a part of, and I want to be in service to the company, I want to be in service to the founders, and I want to be in service to the social sculpture that we're building here.
You spoke to this a little bit, but I'd love to have you dig in a little deeper around this idea of relevance and differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
So I see a lot of creators who have all the differentiation in the world, but it's too far off from where culture is right now, and it tends to not resonate. And then there's obviously a lot of people who just copy each other. They kind of copy what culture is already doing.
Totally.
And they're unoriginal. And what you were speaking to, you know, Mudwater sort of looking like coffee, having the same tactile experience, but being far enough away that it can lead you down this different path, being something that caught your attention. Can you just explain more of that concept of relevance and differentiation?
You're asking great questions. Thanks. I mean, these are like just such seminal questions.
They're all selfish, by the way.
So there's this concept that was coined by an industrial designer in the aerospace industry called MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. And with Sir Kensington's, for instance, we knew that we would have to call it ketchup when we launched, and we would have to put the word ketchup on the bottle, because if we were to call it like tomato relish and make it super chunky, even if it was delicious, it wouldn't end up on anyone's shopping list, and no one would grab it thinking, oh, I can replace my ketchup with this. And if we had made it identical in texture and taste to call it like Heinz ketchup, but it just happened to be organic or just happened to have a, you know, a couple of better for you ingredients, well, it's not really different enough to be interesting, right? It's not different enough to be memorable and distinct and to have its own unique proposition, right, that it lives in. And so most advanced yet acceptable, I think, in the world of consumer is about having one foot in novelty and one foot in nostalgia. Of course, there are cases where something might be so interesting or so innovative or so convenient that it completely changes the way that people use a product, like Spotify versus purchasing CDs, right? And of course, there were steps in between there with iTunes and everything. But in general, when it comes to like consumable products that we have like a taste and a memory for, we need to recognize and rely on all the memories of tasting food and drinking liquids, you know, constantly every day since we were born, to be able to sort of hitch on something and push it forward. And I think media and culture is the same thing too. When you talk about quote unquote creators, right? There are radical messages out there that might find a small niche, but I think the best messages are one that connect on something. Again, going back to the psychographics, a little voice in someone's head that, or maybe a voice in society, right? That what's commonly understood is like the zeitgeist, what the people are paying attention to. They're able to meet that at a specific moment in time and pull that out, and then basically become known for having that message. So I think to get a message to really rip, you've got to understand like how do people make sense of it now based on where culture is, but then how do I push it forward? So how do you find something that's most advanced yet acceptable? The other thing to add to that is this: people talk about quote unquote like differentiation. Like, is it distinct? Is it differentiated? Differentiation for the sake of being different is actually worthless, right? You have to have a useful proposition that meets someone's need or scratches an itch or does something better or more convenient or is in some way like easier to share, right, in terms of virality versus just pure differentiation and distinctiveness.
Yeah. It reminds me of this interview that I listened to with Jerry Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion was about like, well, you should just, comedians should just be speaking their truth and they should, you know, get it out there. And he said, yeah, but, you know, I think you'll find that it's nice to have the audience laugh. Right?
Absolutely.
And yeah. Comedians are, you know, they're the great culture shapers, right? And they're constantly, every night, they're on stage just thinking, okay, what's too far?
Right.
Where can I bring it back? What's that moment, as you said, that people have thought it in their minds, but they haven't recognized it, that thought consciously. And how can you make that unconscious conscious?
Yes.
And culture will pay you to make the unconscious conscious. Absolutely. Because you're helping them understand themselves better.
That is a great way to phrase it. That's a great way to phrase it.
Go.
Related to that, I've got another quote to share that when, and this is actually kind of related to this idea of like making the unconscious conscious or figuring out something that's a little bit better, a different way to do things, that as we were investing in Mud, Shane photographed a page from a Buckminster Fuller book, who is a thinker, an engineer, an artist, a utopian.
Oh, yeah. I know Bucky Fuller. I interviewed his grandson.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. The geodesic dome.
And he has this quote. Buckminster Fuller said, "I'm enthusiastic over humanity's extraordinary and sometimes timely ingenuity. If you're in a shipwreck and all the boats are gone, a piano top buoyant enough to keep you afloat that comes along makes a fortuitous life preserver. But it's not to say that the best way to design a life preserver is in the form of a piano top. I think we're clinging to a great many piano tops and accepting yesterday's fortuitous contrivings as constituting the only means for solving a given problem. And so we've, like, as a society, we've emerged and we've improvised and we've built from what we've had, right? And I think that the great entrepreneurs, great brands, great designers, artists will recognize these moments where it's like, wait a minute, what the hell are all these people doing clinging to a piano top? There's got to be a better way. How about we, you know, invent this? How about we popularize this? And so I think it's a great analog towards creating breakthrough businesses that work with consumers especially.
Which businesses do you think tell the best stories or have told the best stories in the past? Which ones do you look at and you're like, wow, they really changed culture and moved it along, and given my work in business, I kind of see how they did it. Like, I can see under the hood. Are there any examples that really come to mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of specific companies, it's almost contrived because they're so well known for doing just that, right? I mean, I think that, like, Apple, in the way that they were so dedicated to, you know, empowering creatives and also treating their work like this, like it was part of art history, right? It literally is, you know, in the MoMA and in various museums. But if you open up these Apple products, like, the interiors are designed and architected with such incredible precision. And of course, that's like the how, but they've also empowered creators along the way. You know, Nike.
You know, just on the Apple thing, I'm reading a book called Build right now.
Oh, yeah, the Tony Fadell
book.
Yeah, so I need to read that.
Yeah, so he worked on the iPod. It's a really, really good book. I'm learning a lot from it. But he has this this page of Jobs' 2007 speech where he said, he gets on stage and he says, today we're going to introduce three new products, a touchscreen iPod, an internet communications device, and a cell phone.
That's right.
Today we're going to introduce three products.
Yeah.
A touchscreen iPod, a communications device, and a cell phone. Are you getting me?
Yes.
The iPhone.
Wow.
And people still quote that as, like, that having there be a setup and a punchline to the beginning of a speech, and, like, and the way that he... You know, Tony Fadell talks about how, like, you know, it didn't come across as this scripted speech because he had been spending the last few months going around Apple honing this story and seeing what resonated and seeing what lines worked so that when he could bring it out to the world, it felt natural and perfect.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely a lot of preparation went into that. That speech in particular is one of the greatest examples of public speaking that I've ever seen. And I highly recommend, if you're preparing for something, if you're a speech, or if you're even just curious, go on YouTube and watch the 2007 iPhone keynote. It's incredible. And there's a book about public speaking that, like, dissects that whole thing and, like, puts it on a timeline and everything. But that's a great one.
Yeah. So you mentioned, and I want to linger on Apple a little bit,
sure,
too, just because I'm reading that book, so I'm learning a bit more about it. But you talked about empowering creatives. What does that actually mean? Like, what, when you talk about, okay, it's a company that empowers creatives,
yeah,
what does that look like when the rubber hits the road as opposed to a company that doesn't?
Right. So let's move away from the functional a bit and let's talk more about positioning. So a company has the opportunity to decide, okay, do we talk about the product qualities in our advertising or in our messaging? Do we talk about, if you're Apple, the amount of RAM, the megahertz, right? The speed, the processor speed, the amount of storage space, the screen size. Or do we, instead of talking about the what, do we talk about the why, right? And one of Apple's most famous campaigns that happened when Steve came back and was running the company was Think Different, right? And so They did an ad campaign where, instead of saying we're going to talk about the computers, they said we are going to highlight the independent thinkers who have moved society forward across all domains. Pablo Picasso, Martha Graham, Buzz Aldrin, Salvador Dali, right? Kermit the Frog and Jim Henson. And we're going to put the word think different, which, of course, brilliantly is grammatically incorrect, because grammatically correct would be think differently,
yeah.
Right? And I believe that that campaign was hatched about, you know, three blocks up the road in the Chiat Day building, the
one
with the binoculars
Main
Street. And so that is an example of, they're not saying, right, buy this computer because competitively it has the power to get the job done that you need to get done. It's saying, we are a company that celebrates this type of independent, creative, and technical thinking, right? Einstein, Buzz Aldrin. And you can too, right? If you're part of this club, you're part of the Pablo Picasso club. You're part of the Salvador Dali club, right? We are making tools for this class of international creatives, and you get to like drink a little sip from what we're doing with that. And so what that ends up doing is now all of a sudden the products themselves are accessories in the lives of people that occupy that world and that self-identify as technically empowered creatives.
Yeah,
right?
It's the painting that they're putting on their wall. Painting the computer.
Exactly. And now all of a sudden, like if you're a set designer or you're a prop stylist in a Hollywood film, you're making a decision, what kind of computer is sitting on this character's table? Is it a Mac or is it a PC? And if it's a Mac, what does that say about the character themselves? That's when you really know you've made it, right? When you're an accessory to someone's life like that in a communication device. But I would say that what speaking to like the me I want to be, and it's such a genius move on their part, right? Of being able to say like, okay, well, let's not talk about the computers. Let's like tell our customers they're Albert Einstein, right? And that's really good.
That's a very seductive message.
And then I think certainly practically, if you go to the movie studios, right? If you go to the graphic designers, they're generally using Macs, right? And of course they've got the high performance, you know, CPU and RAM and screen and all that kind of stuff to support that. But, you know, other manufacturers could make computers and do make computers with the same specifications. But I think that was really like the difference between the way that a Steve Jobs, you know, thought about computers and the way that Bill Gates thought about computers. Steve Jobs famously, you know, said that if you take all the animals, I don't know if you've heard this, but if you take all the animals in the animal kingdom, humans included, humans are not the fastest. They do not have the most stamina. They cannot run or walk the longest. But if you put a human being on a bicycle, which is completely human powered and is of complete human design, it blows all the other animals out of the water. You put a human on a bicycle and it's going faster than a cheetah. It's going longer than a gazelle. And he said, a computer is a bicycle for the mind.
That's fucking so good.
And so when you think about, let's take all the minds of these great thinkers, Einstein, Martha Graham, Pablo Picasso. Well, the Apple computer is a bicycle for your mind. It was what is going to allow us to become, you know, as a species, more intelligent, more creative, more productive, more connected to each other. And that, I think, is like part of the like deep, deep layers of genius of what Apple represents.
I listened to a great podcast series called Tagline. Do you know about this? It's awesome, man. It's revolutionary ad campaigns throughout history. So it's like the Dos Equis man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Got Milk. It's Apple's Mac versus PC.
Oh, another great one.
Right. And apparently Steve Jobs was very involved in that campaign. And he was like on set. He was the guy who was like, this is how we're going to do it. This is exactly why it needs to work in this way. And the amount of nuance that you glean from this podcast series about just how, you know, the Mac needed to be seen as, you know, cool and easy to use and not pedantic, but also not too mean-spirited. And the amount that Steve was like just on the ground involved in that campaign was really striking to me. you get the sense that he really was a creative at heart. Like his, yeah. he was a storyteller.
Yeah, and with a savant. Big company. Like a, you know, I wish I was 1% that competent. And on top of
you
things.
Think he was a savant?
Oh yeah,
really?
Oh my gosh! I mean, yeah, I think he like obviously he has a lot of mythology that surrounds him, but if half the stories are true, right? I mean, he is really able to like see through the cloud of whatever, right? And see the truth and pull these things out. I'm sure it was a pain to work with.
Right. That times. Sounded like it.
Yeah.
When it comes to why more companies don't put creatives first or put the why first, what do you think are the pitfalls or the missteps that a lot of companies make that make it so that their message, you know, maybe they had momentum and then all of a sudden they falter? And what have you seen as the decisions that growing companies make that get them off course?
The truth is that there are way more companies out there than good ideas. And I think there are way more companies out there than like strong whys, strong messages, right? That's one piece of it is you actually have to have this gift, right? Or like not a gift in the sense that like someone is gifted, but in the sense that you have to have discovered a secret and be telling that secret to people, and that itself is like the core gem, like that's interesting. And there's just not that many gems out there. I mean, I don't think. Maybe I need to think more abundantly. But the other thing is that it can appear very impractical to take that strategy because it's hard to draw a straight line to that and to like starting with why and like selling more product, right? Which is necessary for surviving. It's hard to equate that directly to, expanding distribution, increasing your, margins to survive as a company. And so it almost seems secondary of importance, right? But we like that's the great tension, is that I think the greatest brands are the ones that really hit on the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs about self-actualization. But in order to get there, you have to go through all the other stuff about, getting quality assurance physically right on every single product that you produce, which is extremely hard. And dialing in the product so that it can have a proposition that actually solves a problem for people, that's really hard. I think broadly, one, there's just not that many of these great like gems out there. And then two, it's a long process, right? I mean, Apple's what, a 50-year-old company at this point, something like that, maybe 40, I don't know. I think Mudd is a rare example of a company that had a strong brand from the beginning and has been able to build on that platform. I mean, we still have a long way to go. Some companies lose their way. Some companies lose their way and then come back to it. But it's hard to prioritize and it's hard to maintain that clarity.
Yeah, advertising in a sense is guessing.
Like, sure,
everyone can have all the stats they want or all the experience they want, but you're still just putting something out into culture, hoping that it's going to resonate. And there are certain platforms that resonate more reliably and bring you money back more quickly. Like, for people who don't know, there's something called performance advertising, which is the Instagram or TikTok ads that you see, and you click a button and it goes directly to the company's website. And it's a very rapid way to grow a company because you have these platforms like Facebook that essentially have so much customer data, they can get your company out to huge amounts of people. So that's a more like, it's a more reliable spark to get it back. But then there are other bets where you're like, we're going to make Patagonia, for example, like we're going to make a feature length documentary,
mm-hmm.
like 180 degrees south, and hope that it resonates and hope that it has a longer shelf life. So it's just interesting to think about all of those bets that you're making on any given year about what is actually going to be the canvas that helps shape culture.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's incredibly nuanced and challenging. And it's not as simple as one or the other. It's, of course, both. And then how do you have the right creative talent and technical talent to execute both that's also in line with the message that you're trying to tell and also, you know, delivers on the potential of the business?
What do you, just getting back to Mud, because I think you have really unique insight on this, like a company that's grown from, you know, like 6 employees to 30 employees now in a year, that the structure of the company is changing every week, you know, new systems are being put in place. What are missteps that you have seen in the past for a company of this size at this stage make? Have there been any examples that you've kind of come across of misuses of time or mistakes that companies at this size tend to fall into?
Well, with any business creative endeavor, you can think about times of exploration and times of exploitation. And I think there's both a temptation and also a necessity at this scale to engage in the exploitation of doing what works, right? And so I would say, like, it's a big misstep to kind of get that balance wrong, which is to say, okay, we know it works, we have our models, and we're not really going to question them, or we're just going to turn the crank on them. I think that is definitely a misstep. And I think on the other side, it's like, well, we can still, you know, explore with the whole body of the company, right? And we can still maybe it's bet the farm on a new product introduction and sort of expect the same results from that level of the exploration that we did in the past when we happened to, you know, have lightning in a bottle or, right, struck gold. I think every company has to go through that process of saying, how do we carefully maintain the right balance of exploration and exploitation as we move to a new stage of maturity in our business, and also maturity in the communication strategies, in the marketing strategies, and the product development strategies that we have. So, you know, I wouldn't say that I have anything too sharp here to share, but especially like with the new people that you bring in and the culture that you cultivate, there has to be like a recognition that the same sort of creativity that was there at the founding of the company and the same dedication to getting that unique message out, like building that social sculpture, that has to be maintained, I think, for us to achieve our potential and to really crack the culture code.
Before we sat down, you mentioned coaching and your perspective on coaching, the importance of coaching. And it's, you know, it's just interesting for me to see, you know, as a lowly copywriter, you know, my friend Shane, you know, sort of reaching for the stars and on this, this crazy ascent, and then having other people like yourself come in who you're like, hey, you know, I've actually been in this position before. And it's really fun for you. I can tell to be like, okay, I see this problem that you're facing. Let's work through it together. You know, and one of the first times that I met you on a Mud call, you're like, yeah, just kind of consider me like coach, you know?
Yeah.
So what does that mean to you? You know, the importance of coaching and how do you want to talk about it in this context?
Yeah. Well, something I realized about myself, you know, in particular was actually like running a business and running and being in a business. I found myself, frankly, like paralyzed by fear because of the immediacy of the challenges and the kind of the self-reflection of like, if things don't go as planned, you know, if we don't execute, if we don't pull it together, like it's going to be a catastrophe. Somehow when you're not in the actual seat and you're helping someone else out, for me, that fear dissipates.
It's like editing someone else's work.
It's like editing someone else's work.
It's so easy. Oh yeah, yeah, of course the story doesn't work
You see so much more clarity.
Yeah,
and like,
yeah.
You know, not everyone is like that, right? And like absolutely props to the people that don't have that, you know, same fear. But for me, I found myself much better suited to coaching rather than leading. And I think we are also in a very interesting time in society where coaching is becoming more and more accepted, socially accepted, much more popular, and people see it as not something that's like a sign of weakness. But I imagine that, you know, therapy is more popular than ever. Leadership coaching is more popular than ever. You know, Michael Lewis has a podcast on Malcolm Gladwell's network called Against the Rules. He has an entire season dedicated towards the concept of coaching. And that's a great listen, by the way. But I think that, you know, one of the things, I am very fortunate to have a coach in my life named Charlie, who I met in, 5 or 6 years ago at this point. And he's absolutely like transformed how I'm able to construct healthy relationships from the language and the mental models that I use, and also, you know, to basically hold up a mirror for me and allow me to see things that I didn't otherwise see. And I think it's a luxury in many ways. But I would also, you know, encourage people out there, if you haven't explored coaching, either formal or informal, you know, have that network and lean into it, because it can really go a long way and transform you.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, when I was a kid coming up in surfing, having a coach was seen as super lame.
Right. Yeah, totally.
And now all the best young surfers in America have coaches.
Yeah.
And I think that helping, just having someone help you not develop bad habits when you're starting out can save you years of misery. Because if you're approaching anything with the wrong technique, it's just going to make it way harder. You know, it's like learning how to lift something up with your back instead of bending your knees.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, and I do think that applying the idea of a coach to more athletes or mental athletes is something that will help people get better more quickly, for sure. And it can also just help you get out of your own way. You know, so many people at a certain stage just need to reflect back to someone who's been there or can relate to them or speak the language to make their pursuit feel a bit less lonely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially as more people, you know, engage in remote work, or more people like live away from their families, you know, and they either move somewhere, right? I mean, all these sort of more traditional anchorings that we used to have on the margin are disappearing. And so having someone who is a formal, or at least like an informal designated coach, alleviates that.
We spoke a bit about fundraising, but I just want to dig in a little bit more there, because I think that there's a perception that some people might have out there. I certainly did, that, you know, a company grows, it's cool, it has this great idea, you get a bunch of investors involved, and then they ruin it. You know, and they're, you know, it's just a bunch of greedy investors that take a good idea and, you know, destroy it. And then it just turns into vanilla, and, you know, and subsequently usually it destroys the world in the process.
Yep.
And, you know, you look at a company like Patagonia that just made this move to essentially move a private company, rather than making it public, move it to having the Earth be its only shareholder.
Right.
Which
acquired
is
by Earth.
Acquired by Earth. Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that there's some truth to both sides of this kind of this conversation about like how some companies can get ruined by the wrong investors. But a lot of companies also can't make it to that next stage without investment rounds. How would you sort of explain investment to someone who hasn't thought about it much, and these different paths that a company can take as a result of investors coming in?
Mm. Great question. A lot of layers here.
Yeah. Take it however you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the great coaching concepts that I learned is there are these two triangles, right? When we're met with challenge, we can either go to the drama triangle or we can go to the healthy triangle. And why are they triangles? Well, they have 3 points. The drama triangle is you feel you move into a villain mode, where you tell everyone else that they're wrong, or you point a finger at someone. You go into victim mode, where you're like, woe is me. The world is happening to me. I don't have any control. It always happens like this. Or hero mode, where you're like, I'm the only one that can save the situation and insert myself. That the healthy triangle is maps to that, and that's challenger, creator, and coach. So challenger maps to victim, right? Or sorry, maps to villain. So instead of, you know, pointing at someone and saying they're wrong or that they made a mistake, you say, well, how do we hold up a mirror and say, how do we do better in this scenario? What's the standard that we want to hold ourselves to? And coach maps itself to hero. So instead of inserting yourself in the situation, you actually empower someone to address the issue. And then the most powerful is the foil between creator and victim, right? So instead of being a victim and saying, woe is me, the world is happening to me, there's nothing I can do about it, everyone else is, you know, running their playbook and I'm getting lost in it, the creator says, okay, how do I wrap my hands around this? How do I take agency? What's the world that I want to build? What would need to be true if? And in a company, the leadership has got to retain that agency in the space of a creator, whether they have investors or not, but especially if they have investors. Because if you don't have that strong sense of creator agency, then yeah, people are going to run the company for you, right? That don't have that same vision. And people that might have a seat at the table from an investment perspective, and they might have certain control rights, they might have certain economic rights. If you don't maintain that agency, then you're going to have too many cooks in the kitchen, right? These stories don't always turn out bad, but they often turn out bad. But I think it's you've really got to pick your partners well. You have to understand what you're giving up. And you also have to understand the difference between economic rights and control rights. And they're two very different things. I mean, to have an investor, by definition, is you give up an economic piece of the pie of who owns the company. But you don't necessarily give up control rights of the company, right? The decisions that are made, what strategy the company's taking, you know, when to raise more money, when to sell, when to do this and to do that. And I think if you're not paying attention, you'll end up giving away those control rights. And then all of a sudden you've got more drivers in the driver's seat. But overall, I mean, I would say, one, you know, raise money slowly, like bootstrap if you can, like maintain as much independence as you can for as long as you can. And then if you want to get more people invested in your success, pick your partners very carefully and recognize that you are, you know, you're entering into a bargain here. If you sell a piece of the company, you're going to have to sell it at some point, right? You're going to have to give it back. And unlike a bank or a, you know, someone that lends you money as debt, you're not paying back, you know, 1x with interest. You're paying back many, many multiples of what has been given to you. And so, yeah, you've got to think about it very carefully, but that would be its own episode, I think.
Hmm. And why did you Sir Kensington sell to Unilever?
We did, yeah.
Okay, can you explain, like, so why do you sell a company for people who haven't kind of talked about this or thought about this? Like, what's the point of selling to a parent company?
And there are many different motivations can drive that. And I would say that for us, there were two. One is, you know, when you think about the mission of the company and the potential for the company, we were a very small team. I think we had a sales team of like four people. And by joining Unilever, we then went to a sales team of 400 people across the country. So we were all of a sudden like first in line with all these retailer relationships. We were already, you know, because we were drafting on their coattails, a trusted name. We didn't have to worry about raising money or cash anymore. We had access to much more resources in terms of product innovation, in terms of improving our supply chain. Like the resources that were afforded to us by joining a much bigger entity enabled us to move faster and accelerate our mission and bring our products to more people, right? And that's what created value for us, and it's what created value for them. Mm-hmm. And then also, because we had raised money, you know, from both friends and family, but also from institutions, at some point, those people need their money back. And, you know, that is, again, part of that bargain that you can't really just hold on to the company forever because that's not why those people invested. They are looking for some kind of a realization event, some kind of liquidity event, some kind of return. Not to mention that, you know, we as founders were also shareholders and we had an opportunity to secure our financial future. We had just had kids and it afforded us a lot more freedom in doing that.
Hmm. Okay. You said something interesting in the talk that I listened to, where you mentioned this case of avocado oil in Sir Kensington's mayonnaise,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you were telling this why story about bringing better ingredients into condiments, and then you, over a series of experiences, realized that the avocado oil in the mayonnaise was harmful in a few different ways, as far like workers' rights, or I don't know actually the details of it.
Yeah, I'll give you the skinny of it.
Give me the skinny.
And it's harmful is maybe kind of painting it too strictly, but we use avocado oil in our products, and essentially avocados, very complex supply chain, but avocados which are used for oil are basically, I mean, they're collected in Mexico on avocado plantations. And because avocados are so dollar dense, right, they're such an expensive commodity, the avocado farms and the farmers are often either controlled or extorted by drug cartels. And same thing happens with limes, actually.
Oh, wow.
And but avocados are a particularly difficult place because basically in sort of an like a mafia style protection will have to be paid by these places, and so there isn't the same level of oversight or worker protection or just, you know, general rule of law that you would expect from you'd hope to see from a supply chain. Not to mention that the global demand for avocados has been compounding rapidly. People love avocados, and that leads to things like deforestation and habitat destruction of different animals. And so that is basically, avocados are seen, you know, in American culture, Western culture, as this like very kind of like happy, healthy, like easy product. But in reality, it's much more difficult and much more challenging than that.
Got it.
Yeah.
So in your talk, you said stories are simple, but the truth is complex. Stories can sometimes flatten things. And then you go on to say, so, you know, as a founder, it was important for me to realize when to present questions rather than answers.
Oh, yeah.
So dig into this a bit more, because I do think that this kind of comes back to, you know, we are presenting stories as businesses that move out into culture. But what happens, you know, when the story isn't as simple? It's, you know, it's never as simple. And when it's important as a founder, or as a leader, or just a person within that company to start asking questions rather than having the answers.
Yeah. Well, I think in that case specifically, it's like, you know, when you talk about start with why, it's based, you know, you're telling someone a story that they love hearing and they love believing and they love enrolling in. It's a very one-to-many approach, right? And it's intoxicating. We love stories. We love protagonists. We love winners and losers. But in this case specifically, you know, we didn't have a clear answer of like, well, what should we do about this, right? Should we change the supply chain and that would make the product so expensive that no one would buy it? Would we like basically eliminate the product entirely, which was one of our most successful products at the time that clearly customers were hungry for and clamoring for? And so it was a couple of years ago at this point, but we went through an exercise in a kind of an annual summit where we posed all the facts to people and we gave them the challenges and we asked, like, what should we do about this as a company, right? What's in line with our values and what's practical, you know, for the business? And so I think that was a powerful moment because we were moving from just like, oh, like, we're making condiments with like better ingredients and like, why don't the big guys do this? And like, it's so easy, right? And it's like very, you know, it's surface level. But this was an opportunity to say, like, hey, like, we're gonna open the door to something that's a little more unsavory, that also represents the sheer complexity and interconnectedness of our universe. What do we do about it?
Right.
You know, not a clear answer.
Yeah. And you mentioned this before, as far as something to dig into a little bit regarding seeing business as
either a success or a failure, and how often we oversimplify the story of a business as being either a successful business or a failed business.
Yeah.
When often it's more complex when you broaden your definition of success or failure. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. And so I think one of the things that I've only got like perspective on now that I've run the course of like starting and you know, growing with a team and selling the company and integrating and all that, now also looking at other businesses, right? Is so often the narrative, whether it's like at a team retreat or at a fundraising announcement, is like, we're killing it, right? Or it's we're getting killed, right? And if you look at the news headlines, they seem so polarizing of either like we're killing it or we're getting killed. And I'm sure that people can relate to this, whether you're a startup founder or even, you know, you're just engaged in a creative or a professional pursuit, is that actually you're simultaneously killing it and getting killed. Like, that's what you got to realize, is like, it's possible to have parts of your job, parts of your role, parts of your business that are actually like world leading, world class, completely breakthrough, but also like inherently like messed up and broken and unsustainable. And again, we want to live in this world of simplicity where it's like, well, how are we doing as a company? Like, we're doing great. Or like, how are we doing as a company? Like, we suck and everyone should leave, right? You know, and by the way, the grass is always greener, but anywhere you go, you're simultaneously going to have this tension of feeling like we're killing it and we're getting killed. And I think recognizing that and being able to like take the moment to like celebrate the wins and be proud of what we've created, be proud of what you've created, that is going to give you the oxygen to approach the challenges in a way that is like as devoid of your ego as possible, and have the clarity to actually address these things and fix them or live with them. Sometimes it's just about living with them, right? The avocado oil thing, we're just living with it, you know? And that's different than having like a neat solution for everything. But, you know, businesses, all of them are simultaneously successes and failures.
And the great stories of our time show the dichotomy, right? The best characters, the ones that go on to really have myth around them, aren't just saints or sinners.
No. Right?
There's a little bit of both. And I think that that's inherent in all good art, because the reality of being human is that both are true simultaneously. And when good art can show us that,
absolutely,
it helps us understand ourselves better.
Absolutely. It's like Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's got a peace sign and he's got a patch on his helmet that says Born to Kill.
Yeah.
And the commanding officer says, "What's the deal? How do you have both of those in your helmet?" And he says, "Sir, I think I was trying to suggest something about the duality of man, sir."
So good. Oh, that's so good. Why do you think everyone should take improv?
Oh, well, I had the benefit of falling into some improv when I was in high school, and I was in an improv troupe. And improv, you know, I'm sure everyone's got a sort of base level of understanding of it, but, you know, improv is essentially unscripted theater, where you're given an unspecified location and some sort of a relationship. Sometimes there are games, but you basically just... you kind of start from nothing and you create in front of you. And business has, or and improv has a couple of great rules to it. The first and most important rule that we played by was never say no to your partner. And so that's also can be interpreted as affirm and elevate. Play the ball as it lies, right? So if someone brings something to you, instead of being like, oh, no, that's not the right way to do it, or I don't know about that, it's basically like, all right, we'll take that and be like, yes. And also, what more can we do on that?
So
and
if I'm like, hey, here, catch this soccer ball.
Oh.
And you can't be like, that's not a soccer ball.
Yeah, be
ball.
Like, oh, I don't see anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, because then the scene is dead, right? Yeah. But if you just carry it with you and you do the shtick, you do the bit, right, then all of a sudden you're in this, like, creative place, affirming each other and building. And I'm actually convinced that I don't have any business skills. Like, I only have improv skills.
Me too, after this interview, man.
I mean, like,
I think that every listener
is
convinced
of that. If you, like, show
up
to things
that.
And you're curious and you're like, oh, yes, and you start to build on things with people, all of a sudden people are like, oh, this guy's great. You know, and you're like, well, I'm just, like, acting the part here. I'm just improvising. Yeah. I'm just saying yes and to everything. And I thought that was funny, too, because when I my first full-time job, I worked at actually an investment bank, and, like, we would wear suits to the office. And I was like, funny costumes.
Yeah.
You know, these things are just like costumes.
You know what's funny is there's an improv practice that you can do where you show up on stage pretending to wear something.
Uh-huh.
And then you act out the person who would wear that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's remarkable how quickly you can get into character.
Oh, gosh.
By going on imagining yourself
in an
investment banker suit. And I think that's often what clothes do for us, is it gives us permission to play the part.
Absolutely. And then the other thing about improv is about commitment, because you got to commit to the scene, right? You don't break character, crack up. If you really commit to the scene, you, using the Vince Lombardi quote, act like you've been there before. And all of a sudden, if you find yourself in a kind of a, call it a business context or creative context, but you're like fully playing the part and you're in the scene, you're like getting deeper into it, people will key off that energy and they'll follow you in it. And it allows you to get your head in the game and put other people in the game too. I would say the other thing about improv, and it sounds like you've done a bit of improv, but very important element in improv to be aware of is what's called status. And in any scene, any social situation, people walk in with a self-ascribed status. They either feel meek or they feel dominant. And generally, status is on a scale between like 1 to 10. In society, you mostly run into people between like 6s and 9s, I would say. Maybe 5s and 9s.
Let me think. Wait, so...
Well, just it's very rare to find someone that is like ultra meek.
Right.
In a social context. I mean, maybe it happens, but it's more of an outlier. And it's also rare to find someone that's like a complete, like, domineering. Maybe it clusters more around 5. You know, there's probably a normal distribution of these things.
Right, right.
But I think that's another interesting piece, too, is if you're aware of status.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, you know, we could walk outside and see a lot of unhoused people, right? So those are low status.
That's absolutely true.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I would say I'm probably biased towards the social situations I find myself in.
Okay, so you're talking about social
situations.
But yes,
if we're talking about society as a whole,
you're running into people all across the status spectrum just walking down the street. But you're talking about like clustering in a group,
even
situation.
An office or something like
sure,
that. Yeah,
sure.
But I would say, being status aware and like recognizing that people like play games with themselves, they self-ascribe status, they ascribe status to others, that can be a really powerful tool too, because that's a very important for influence, and you can play with that as well.
Totally. And just, you know, status is seen, it's kind of a taboo subject.
Like, very taboo. Talk about, in America it is.
In America it's very taboo, but that's really... all we're doing all the time is understanding status, who's high status, who's low status, how can we gain status within a certain game that we're playing.
Yeah.
And your status dissolves depending on the room that you're in or even the conversation that you're a part of, right?
Like, absolutely.
All of a sudden we're in a group of surfers and all of a sudden Scott's low status because we're talking about the waves and all these terms, all this jargon that you don't understand, right?
Yep.
And then we get into a room of investors and all of a sudden now I'm low status because I don't understand those acronyms. So it is so interesting just how it shifts depending on where you are. And it, you know what, it just made me think, like, a lot of good stories are ones where there's this crazy tension between someone who's high status and low status. Like, there was a story that I wrote maybe a year ago for Trends with Benefits.
Right.
And I think it was the most read story I've put up there, called Sally Jones, You Better Watch Your Speed. And it was about this friendship that I made with this homeless woman. And she lived right down the street from me where I would go grocery shopping. And we just sort of developed this friendship. And she would always tell me that I needed to read. She would kind of like scold me, telling me that I needed to like educate myself. And there was like, I'm only noticing it now, but the story had all of these, shifts in status throughout the narrative.
Interesting.
Like, right? Like, so she doesn't have a home, yet she's telling me, like, how I need to live my life. And it's just, I think that there can be a lot of room for good storytelling when you start thinking about story through statuses and how they change.
Yeah. No doubt.
So coming down to the end here, but I want to stay on the status conversation, you know, because you recently flung yourself into a triathlon.
Uh-huh.
Which was a new world for you. Tell me, you know, what was that like? And do you, you know, actively seek out these new areas of, like, where you will be the floundering noob?
Sure.
And why is that important? You know, I mean, it's fun. I mean, you're a successful dude. And you also seem to have maintained perspective on yourself.
You flatter me.
Well, it's cool, man. I mean, I wouldn't have you on the podcast if you're a dick. Like, you know, so it's cool. And I think that's...
It wasn't my contract, though.
Yeah, exactly. that was part of the investment. Like,
I need at least 75 minutes of airtime.
Exactly. I'm going to profess my truth.
You know, I mean, I love to keep peeling off the layers of the onion. And I'm motivated by really two things. One is honing my craft. And the second is by adventure. And adventure comes with levels of discomfort and levels of novelty and challenge. And so for me, you know, signing up for the triathlon and just making the decision to do it was an adventure. And there was a moment, the hardest part for me that I thought was going to be the hardest part was the ocean swim. And I can swim, but swimming in a pool is very different than swimming in the ocean because, sure, you don't have, you know, the visibility and sure, you don't have the walls to push off. But when you're swimming in the ocean, you have this whole mental element, which is like, am I getting sucked away by a riptide? Like, what is this on my foot? Like, is it seaweed
slimy,
or is it a great white shark?
Yeah.
And the brain, like, creates these stories and creates all this intensity. And for me, that was a little bit overwhelming. And I went, you know, the week before I was swimming in the ocean alone because I needed to get the time in, you know, training for this triathlon. And I got knocked by a huge wave that just, you know, pulled me under with so much force. And I was like, man, I am not ready for this. And I was panicking for a second and I'm thinking, what have I done? But then I remembered. There's this great tale that I always kind of come back to, which is that in ancient Greece, the Greek sailors would leave the port of Athens, and you know the port of Athens and the bay there was protected. It was calm water, you know, it was a great port, and they would go along the side of the, you know, the craggy rock cliffs on their way to the open ocean, to the Aegean. And right when you get to the tip of the land from crossing from the port into the open ocean was the Temple of Poseidon. And Poseidon was, of course, the god of the weather and the god of the sea. And they would pray in that moment to Poseidon for calm seas and to spare their lives. And then they would go out after that moment of recognition into the open ocean to whatever battle they were going to fight or whatever mission they had to go on. And so for me, that right there was a Temple of Poseidon moment, right? You're in the moment, you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not ready for this. I'm getting hit by a big wave. And then you realize, oh no. This is just the moment where you have to recognize the fear between the world you know that is known and the world that is unknown, that you always have to fulfill that mission. You got to make that leap, right? And so just by recognizing it, just by seeing it and by acknowledging the fear, I find myself like those are really special moments to push on. And I love finding and recognizing those moments and peeling off the layers of the onion.
Yeah. Those are the moments of growth. Hell yeah, man. This was a really fun podcast and a really helpful podcast.
Thanks.
I super appreciated it. Yeah. This is sick.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, click the link below and sign up for my Substack newsletter. Every Friday, I send one newsletter with a new word that I learned or think is cool and write a little something about that word. So if you love growing your vocabulary, if you're the kind of weirdo who thinks that reading is sexy, click the link below or go to tierman.substack.com. That's tierman.substack.com to sign up for the weekly newsletter. Thank you to everyone who donates to this podcast via Substack. I rely on listeners like you to keep this thing going. So if you have some extra change, if this is the kind of thing that you want to support, I very much appreciate those paid subscriptions. And if you don't have the cash, just sign up for it for free. No big deal. Go be a good person. Get out into the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.